Good morning, I'm Bella Johnson, and you're listening to Alternative Currents. Today's guest, Stephanie Kaza, is here to introduce her new book, Hooked, Buddhist Writings on Greed, Desire, and the Urge to Consume, published by Shambhala. Stephanie has also written The Attentive Heart, Conversations with Trees, and co-authored Dharma Rain, Sources of Buddhist Environmentalism, both also published by Shambhala Press. Stephanie Kaza is Associate Professor of Environmental Studies at the University of Vermont, where she teaches religion and ecology, ecofeminism, and unlearning consumerism. She's a longtime Zen student. Welcome to Alternative Current, Stephanie.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you. Stephanie, so many of us forget what it takes to bring what we perceive our daily needs to our door. And further, most of us do not probably realize the full environmental impact of our human thumbprint in nature. Could you talk about our collective history as consumers and how this impacts our world on a daily basis for the average American?
Well, it's a kind of a big story here, so maybe we could just start by thinking about coffee for a minute and make it something you can imagine, because many people drink coffee or buy coffee. And so let's say you drink on average 2 cups a day. A year's worth of your coffee would require about 18 pounds of beans per year, and that would come from approximately 12 coffee trees, but also 11 pounds of fertilizers and pesticides. And once those beans were picked, 40 pounds of coffee pulp would be released into rivers, consuming the oxygen of the rivers as they decompose. And then, of course, the beans need to be roasted, and then they are packed in bags and shipped by trucks. And this one crop is sent all around the world. So I start with that as an example because in our globalized economy, the impacts are so widespread and so invisible to us that it's actually very hard to get a handle on this. Whether it's, you know, thinking of our orange juice at breakfast that's come from maybe Brazil, or apples from New Zealand, or bananas from Costa Rica. We just go to the markets, and there they are, and they've appeared magically somehow. But as trade has expanded dramatically, the problems have increased with that. So we might go back in time a little bit to, say, when the United States, just to take this country, was first forming. Well, it was a pretty minimalist lifestyle. In fact, you could call it puritanical. Not too much a trade, relatively speaking, and not a lot of emphasis on goods and stuff. In fact, that was seen as being somewhat unreligious. But as the United States gained its political footing, one of the ways it developed was through more trade across, of course, with Europe and with other countries, and a greater interest in prosperity. And then, of course, we did have the slave trade, which enabled us to produce even more goods at a time. So despite the slight setback during the Great Depression and World War II even, our greatest expansion of consumption in this country and in general in the West and in the industrialized nations has been since World War II. Just an astonishing boom in production and trade and also therefore consumption. And we should say that along with that, there have been a number of social revolutions which have contributed to that. Much of the household labor used to be contained in the home. Women primarily did the cooking, the gardening, the food storage, the laundry, the clothes making. But once women joined the labor market, somebody had to make clothes and wash clothes and make food. So business simply soared in terms of clothing production and food. So now most things we need, we buy. And the impact of that has what we call a large ecological footprint. All across the land, wherever it's taken energy and wherever it's taken raw materials, each of these products leaves behind them an ecological wake of impact.
So I wonder how it is that we've come to a place where after 9/11, after the towers were hit, one of the first things that we heard as a conciliatory advice from our president was go out and buy something. Just, you know, stimulate the economy, go out and buy something. What an odd commentary to a tragedy such as that.
Well, I thought so myself at the time, and I gave a few talks around here about that, but I understand it psychologically because one of the strong marketing messages resonating through all of consumerism, that is that if you are not feeling the way you would like to feel, if there's some problem or you want to feel good in a new way, there is a product out there that will help you do that. So no matter what the actual material is, the consistent message is something, some material good will help you feel better. So in a way, President Bush was being very consistent with that message, which is penetrating all of our media today. And he also knew people were feeling very bad. It was a very great tragedy, and many people did not know how to cope with it. And we did not have national mechanisms for dealing with such strong emotions. So it was probably a pretty inadequate response, but it was very consistent with today's consumer society.
Right. Yeah, but reading in your introduction, Kelly Lawson, author of Culture Jam, speaks of microjolts of commercial pollution that flood our brains, about 3,000 marketing messages per day. Every day, an estimated 12 billion display ads, 3 million radio commercials, and more than 200,000 TV commercials are dumped into North Americans' collective unconscious.
It's quite a lot. An assault, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And so much so that even those of us, I think, that are really trying to be aware of these things, and those of us who don't watch even a lot of television, are still so inundated. It's so much of a part of us that I think your book is a good reminder of just how insidious this can be and how it is consistent or inconsistent with our spiritual practice.
Well, it even goes beyond the messages themselves now. Even if you choose to somehow renounce some of those contact points, whether you don't watch television or you go spend less time in a shopping mall or you listen to non-commercial radio, the entire culture has made this shift where we think of people as clients. I say in a university campus, students are often talked of in the upper administration as the customers. So this whole, the metaphors of the consumer society are being used in almost every facet of life. So it's like our metaphor for today, and it's very, very difficult to escape from. In fact, it even is being used in spiritual realms, so that certain evangelical churches today have very well-developed marketing plans for how to attract more customers. And in fact, one publishing company wanted recently to put a version of its Bible in Rolling Stones magazine, and this generated quite an ethical debate about should the Rolling Stones carry this consumer message about buying this particular company's Bible. So in order to exist almost today, you have to sell yourself and your product, even if it's a spiritual product you're selling. And that certainly raises issues with some of the earliest understandings of what spiritual practice and spiritual enlightenment might be about. I know in my book, I've tried to look at that through a Buddhist lens, but one could certainly easily also take a Christian or a Jewish or a Muslim perspective and ask many of the same questions.
Right. For those of you who've just turned in, I'd like to remind you that you're listening to Stephanie Kaza talk about her book today, Hooked, a new release by Shambhala Press in February. So the spiritual seeker is consumer, one of the subjects of Thubten Chodron, is that how you pronounce the name of this? Yes, essay, Marketing the Dharma. Very, very important information, I think, to get a grasp of or just to have presented in this way. How does consumerism manifest on the part of the student, the spiritual student?
Yes, as a teacher, Thubten Chodron has observed every one of these things that she mentions. And as somebody who's caught herself about, do I need to market myself in order to get students or to raise money for a retreat center, she models really for us and other teachers and students the kind of ethical struggle that we can engage in around these questions. She discusses, of course, the American mind of, well, I'll go shopping for my spiritual teacher. I'll try this retreat center this week and that teacher next week and maybe this temple the following week, never really settling on any particular commitment, which is, of course, the harder challenge, or the kinds of dilemmas that the teachers run into. If you look in the back of any religious magazine of any denomination, you'll see many advertisements for retreats and spiritual teachers of various sorts, and it is all reflects today's modern graphics and who is going to be attracted to who according to the way it looks.
And what must be the temptations too on both ends of that? You know, both the consumer looking at the teacher, but also the teacher. What happens to teachers when the adoration and the money start pouring in from these extreme coffers in this country?
Well, as Tubton points out, this can cause a sort of level of personal corruption that is happens in any kind of business or any situation where a lot of money pours towards someone, and it generates a kind of arrogance or a kind of false sense of ego, and gets spoiled at some level, and the money gets spent poorly or causes some kind of scandal within the center, and then you have trouble that you might not have had with less money involved. But on the other hand, if you don't fundraise, then if you actually believe in the spiritual practice you're promoting, it makes it more difficult to share it with others. A larger center will have more bigger hall and more rooms for people to stay overnight and more accommodations for teachers, and so you can just do more there. So it's a very fine balancing act, and I suppose ethical scrutiny and ethical integrity is the through line in considering all of this.
Yeah, you talk about, she talks about, Thubten talks about the enchantment of status in her essay.
Mm-hmm.
About, trying to get to a quote here, but I can't right away. But it's just interesting. I find it an interesting commentary. There's been so much that's happened since the 60s, when so many of these things began to hit the mainstream in this country. And time after time, you know, seeing a spiritual leader kind of fall from grace in a way for acts that may or may not have been in line with their teachings.
Well, we might look directly at what that status-seeking attitude is, because it happens in all realms, whether you're trying to achieve academically or in business or in sports or in music. It's almost a biological drive that if you move higher up a certain ladder, you will be guaranteed more security, either through money or through recognition. So that's almost built in, you might say, to the human drive to feel secure and just able to exist in comfort. So if you take that and put it in a religious kind of frame, some of the ways people gain status is by comparing which teachers they've studied with or what they've been able to buy of some a spiritual item, like a beautiful Tibetan Tonka painting, for example, or a gorgeous Buddha statue, or if you were speaking in a Christian terms, maybe a very expensive cross, or perhaps spiritual books, or events that you participated in. And people gossip with each other, literally, comparing notes. And that's when they're each kind of buffeting up their egos one to the other. And we might imagine teachers doing possibly something similar in terms of how many donors they've obtained or how much they've been able to expand. Although she, the author here, can speak more to the students because she's had more contact with them than teachers. But because there's so much fallibility involved in these kinds of investigations, I guess you would say, around status and so on, it's very easy to make mistakes and be supported by others in making them. So almost always when you find a spiritual teacher that's suffered some problems, the community has gone right along with a lot of what came before the exposure. So a kind of co-creation of debacle between the consumer society context and then what's programmed in there to the conditioned minds of the students and the teachers.
Right. Yeah, I think it's the way that this may be moving towards something positive in the way of social change is that spirituality is becoming more integrated into everyday living. I mean, I think that's the good part of it because it's so out there. But then it also becomes subject to, you know, the consumerist mentality that everything else is subject to on a material level. But I think the good part of it is that, you know, it is finding its way into the mainstream more and more. And I'm talking about spirituality versus religion.
Does seem to be a tremendous hunger these days across all the different forms of world religions, and then, as you say, also a spiritual kind of experience that may not be easily categorizable in a world religion sense, a need for deeper ethical integrity, a need for some kind of unifying worldview, and a need for certain kinds of spiritual practices you can do with others in community, even if they're not members of a congregation. That may just be something like a drumming circle on the solstice, or it may be working in a soup kitchen with other people to help other people who have less to eat. But that kind of hunger, I think, is emerging in our society today because we've seen such terrible scandals, and we feel that there is a lot of corruption in different levels in politics and in business. And so the common person, you know, wants something better than that, and knows that it's possible that human beings can aspire to be kinder and more caring and more have more integrity with each other.
Right. Yeah. It's all interesting. I'd like to go back to kind of one of the first essays and talking about the actual Dalai Lama going out and window shopping, I think it was, before one of his talks, and the fact that he even felt his desire provoked by doing this, I found interesting.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Yes, as Joseph Goldstein says, Joseph is the author of this first chapter, and he's one of the leading teachers of Southeast Asian Vipassana Buddhism, teaches in a retreat center in Massachusetts. So he says this: if even the Dalai Lama sees wanting arise in the mind, we know this is not trivial conditioning. As he points out, it is hardwired into our biology. This is not something that we just thought of because we happen to live in a society today. Consuming is what keeps you alive. So we have to consume something. You have to eat, you have to drink, and oftentimes you have to undertake certain consuming patterns to retain your status within a social group, or you risk ostracism and being thrown outside that protective social group. So this has become, in modern-day society, a very sensory-rich stimulation kind of event. So it's not merely a matter of going out and, you know, picking some berries. It's that each of these places that are offering us something we could possibly choose to consume are sending tremendous sensory barrages our way all the time. You just think about walking through a shopping mall and you hear the music, and then you see the clothing on the racks out front of the store, and then you see many colored banners, and your senses are really quite overwhelmed. So even the most conditioned, trained mind, like the Dalai Lama, will still feel that assault, even though he has probably more restraint than anybody else to not act on his sensory stimulation. But most of the rest of us are not that well trained. We're weaker. We smell chocolate or coffee coming out of a shop as we walk by, and almost instantly after that first smell, we have a thought that says, I'd like some of that chocolate. And then we make a left turn, and before you know it, we're in there buying some. So without the counter training to resist the kind of stimulation of the senses, we really are at the mercy of them. This is actually what Pema Chodron talks about in the next chapter, about the process of getting hooked, how that hooking hooks into this deep biological conditioning. And once we are hooked, it's difficult to get unhooked. We're hooked to satisfy the desire to respond to the sensory stimulation and in some way to act on it, because somewhere deep in our mental conditioning is the sense that this could be a life or death kind of thing. If we smell salt or fat or something sweet as an animal, we would go towards it to be sure we had enough food for that season. So learning how to recognize the hooking process is a very powerful kind of practice and insight that she recommends. And it goes along with what Joseph Goldstein was talking about in terms of developing awareness and mindfulness practices, to just see that moment when you hear the thought, I want some of that chocolate, and then be able to be at a choice point. Do I act on this or not act on it? Do I just simply see it as a thought and as a piece of sensory information that came and, in fact, will go, too? It's impermanent. It arises and passes away. And Pema suggests that the process of getting unhooked, of not responding, what the word is shenlok in Tibetan, and it means turning your hooking experience upside down, sort of shaking it all around so you're not so caught by it, whether it's an emotional hook or a sensory hook. And once you are able to kind of turn it upside down and get a little bit unhooked, you generate quite a bit of space around something that before was closing down space. And it offers the opportunity for your own wisdom to develop in that space, your sense that you are able to choose and think ethically about a situation. So this very nexus of studying the hooking process and the unhooking process can be very powerful spiritual practice. So, of course, the way I see this is that we're in a tremendous context for spiritual practice. If consumerism is all around us, then we have many, many opportunities to learn this, how this hooking and unhooking can work. It's kind of a gold mine, if you can see it in a positive sense.
Right, and she's so wonderful. She's so wonderful in just really being so open and forgiving of her readers. You know, I must say the things that I've read of hers and I've read a lot of her work really allows a lot of room for our humanness. One of the things that she says in this essay that I really like, the ego is clinging. This is ego clinging or self-absorption. When we are hooked on the idea of good experience, self-absorption gets stronger. When we are hooked on the idea of bad experience, self-absorption gets stronger. This is why we as practitioners are taught not to judge ourselves, not to get caught in good or bad. I just like the way she always steps back and it's just, you know, just be with it. Just be with it. Just observe it. Become the observer. I'm sorry, go ahead.
She's pointing to a very fundamental Buddhist process there, too, which is at the center of all Buddhist teaching and training, which is to expose the ego-generating process and to work with detaching from it and not encouraging it. Because from a Buddhist philosophical perspective, everything that generates a sense of the importance of I or me or mine actually helps to create the delusion that you live in a world in which you're separate from other things. So the Buddhist fundamental law of reality is that all of reality exists in interdependence and is mutually co-created, that you really are not separate from all the rest of the causes and conditions around you. So anything that generates this ego kind of response of, oh, I had a really good meditation, or oh, I'm such a bad meditator. Those are both ego responses, and they both separate you from the richer, dynamic, flowing world that's ongoing all around you. And so she's working that very basic Buddhist teaching in those statements you read.
Yeah, but also it's really learning to be gentle, you know, learning to be kind with ourselves and not beat ourselves up because we have an ego or see that as something that's, we want, you know, that's bad.
It's something to study. That's all it is. And because there's always plenty of information around that, we will always have something to study. And that's why Buddhist practice is kind of a lifelong commitment in that sense. But that study is, if you compound it with additional pain by judging yourself and resisting and, you know, throwing out the parts you don't like, then you don't get very far in terms of really being with the reality of what's there, which can be sometimes very painful. So her kindness is a way to allow us to get to some of the deeper levels of conditioning and understand it almost impersonally. Like this is just how it all evolved together. I was there, but so were my parents, so was the consuming society, so were my teachers, many, many different factors leading to certain constructs in the mind.
Right. I love in Ajahn Amaro Bhikkhu's Three Robes is Enough, middle way advocacy. The quote, the Buddha gave this discourse shortly after his enlightenment when the monastic community was growing and in need of some guidelines for the monks and nuns. And this is for people that he considered already enlightened. I just have to say that I think so many of us are working toward or believing in enlightenment. But to say he's giving this advice to those who he believed already enlightened. Patient endurance is the supreme practice for burning up unwholesome states, restraining all harmful speech, hurting none, being self-possessed in the way of virtue, knowing the right amount in taking food, having a secluded place for sleeping and meditation, making efforts to practice with a pure heart. These are the teachings of all the Buddhas. And again, just striking that that advice is still needing to be heard by those considered already enlightened.
Yes, this chapter is a particularly important one in the book because Ajahn Amaro is a teacher of the oldest traditions of Buddhism that come from Southeast Asia, and these were all passed on orally from person to person for about 500 years. So the form of the teachings when you read them today are often in this kind of advice form or storytelling. They're very common sense. They're very easy to access, and very, very comforting almost. You read it and you think, well, that just makes sense. They're not quite as elaborate or baroque or sophisticated as some of the northern schools in China and Tibet and Japan. So I thought it would be very important to have at least one author go back to the roots of Buddhism and, as he has done, pull out the texts that offer teachings on anything relating to desire and contentment and simplicity and renunciation. Very simple practices, which can be done without having to be a monastic. One can simply say, for example, I think I will give up drinking soda pop, just because it costs so much to package, and it's mostly sugar anyway, and it's generating a lot of containers, and who knows how many are getting recycled. So I just think I'll have a little practice of renunciation around soda pop. That's something one could do and feel very supported from these early Buddhist teachings. I should say as an aside for your listeners that one of these teachings on contentment was thought to be terribly threatening during the time when Thailand was expanding in its globalization of trade. Some of the early Western advisors to the Thai government and to their economics people said, you know, if your people are too content, they won't buy things. That will be a problem. So they made a specific recommendation to the Buddhist patriarchy, and Thailand is a Buddhist country, so there's a kind of like the Catholic Church, there's an official a Buddhist agency that runs all the temples over there. And they said, we want you to outlaw that teaching on contentment. And this order actually went down through all the different Buddhist monasteries and retreat centers and temples. And except for one person, Buddhadasa, a leading activist monk, who really questioned it and said that this teaching of contentment was one of the most profound teachings of the Buddha. And it wasn't really appropriate for political advisors to outlaw it. So there was some debate around it, but it had a profound consequence and was definitely part of Thailand's capitalization and when it became part of those Asian tigers and its great expansion. So now there's just as many, you know, plastic bags generated in Thailand as there are anywhere else in the industrialized country.
Right.
So these are revolutionary concepts that seem so straightforward and simple, but to go back and retrieve them from the spiritual literature can be a very powerful act and a great contribution for today's efforts to understand the impacts of consumerism.
Right. Well, it's time to take a little break. I'd like to remind listeners that we're speaking today on Alternative Currents with Stephanie Kaza, author of Hooked, Buddhist Writings on Greed, Desire, and the Urge to Consume. You're listening to Alternative Currents on WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 Bangor, and perhaps you're live streaming it on the intranet via WERU.org. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
Where is the beautiful family home that I was was promised on the news at 10. Like my personal place in the sun, it never happened alone. And as for the greatest love of all, that's been sworn in a billion lies, and is mine by birthright, of it I've seen none. Tell me where's my everything? Tell me where's my everything? Where are the children 2.3 that were meant to be sent to me? The patter of whose tiny feet would make my life so sweet. They've been filed along with a pot of gold that was meant to cement my nest and help to keep out the cold while keeping in the rest. Tell me where's my everything? Tell me where's my the monument I'll leave to a grateful nation whose citizens will bend the knee each time my tale is told. Tell me where's my everything? A pot of gold that was meant to cement my nest and help to keep out the cold while keeping in the rest. Tell me where's my everything? Tell me where's my everything? Tell me where's my everything? Tell me my everything.
And welcome back. That's Nick Lowe speaking or singing about that feeling of being betrayed by the American dream when we're promised that that is exactly what we'll get in this consumerist culture. And now, you know, globally, this going on through the world, people looking at having the same quality of life as this country, ecologically, that just seems wild.
Well, actually, you're right. This is documented quite beautifully in last year's State of the World report, which I highly recommend to people. This is a kind of report that's written each year from the World Watch Institute, and last year the entire report was focused on the consumer society. And you can get portions of it, I'm pretty sure, from their website, www.worldwatch.org. Tremendous amount of information there. What they point to, which is particularly frightening, is that looking at population and consumption curves, the population curves have actually dropped off somewhat. We used to be quite frightened about the enormous rates of explosion of population all around the world, but through education and economic aid and a number of other factors, sizes of families generally are dropping. However, the levels of consumption show no such similar pattern. They are only rising, particularly in the two large nations of China and India, which have, you know, many, many people. India alone is over a billion. And within those countries, there now is a significant consumer class, and the appetites for consumer goods are expanding rapidly. So China, for example, is now, it used to be known as the bicycle capital, you know, of the globe, and now has closed many streets in Beijing and other major cities to bicycles in order to allow the cars, all the newly purchased cars, to dominate the streets. So we're seeing major shifts in energy production, energy use, energy buying, material goods flows that represent this shift in consumption. And there's no real indication that the amount of consumption is dropping in any way. It's more like all the less developed countries want to catch up wherever they're able, both for subsistence reasons and for, you know, privilege or entertainment or luxury reasons, with the highest levels they can achieve. as if achieving a high level of consumption is the top status symbol one could hope for in the world. But unfortunately, even at the levels we're consuming right now on the planet, we're way beyond our ecological footprint allotment. If we took the footprints for each of the industrialized countries and calculated that out for everybody, we would need 5 more planets. So we're clearly in a state that's not sustainable. And the more information we have about that, the better. How we'll actually change some of these actions is a pretty big puzzle. And it's not like we can legislate for other countries what they should do, nor they for us, much as, you know, they might like to. And we're seeing some of these difficulties play out, for example, in the ratification and approval process for the Kyoto Treaty regarding global climate change. We see arguments playing out around international treaties on pesticides. And all the countries take different positions as they're trying to sort out who's responsible and who should cut back and who should take the lead. In our own country, we've actually taken quite a few backward steps in the last 4 years, which is unfortunate. But I will say that hasn't slowed anybody else down around the planet. And there are some really wonderful, wonderful initiatives taking place in Germany and Japan and Australia, New Zealand, Canada. Many of these are detailed in the State of the World report, so it's actually quite a hopeful report because there's bright human creativity going on everywhere. So just for example, in Germany, there's legislation that now mandates that companies producing computers and other hard goods like that must be prepared to recycle the materials that were in their original computers. So when you're done with your computer that's outdated, you take it back to the factory. You don't take it to the dump. And this means they're designing computers differently because they know they'll be reusing some of the materials, and some of the materials are toxic, and could they replace them? So they're asking questions in a whole new way. Or the example I really like in Duncan Williams' chapter in the book is about the solar panels on the Zen temple roofs. Very amusing to think about solar panels across all these gorgeous old Japanese Zen temples. But it was a fairly radical act in Japan to not just convince the parishioners that they should have these solar panels, but that they could invest in their own local bank through the purchase of the panels. And they structured a whole new independent consumer-driven bank for the local municipality that had locally contained energy generation with the solar panels and locally contained credit generation, too. So people could borrow money from this bank. And the bank was able to do a number of environmental initiatives, such as entice people to buy energy-saving refrigerators by giving them a certain discount or incentive or subsidy. So the whole system ended up generating more and more sustainability and more positive community, all based on the initiatives of this Buddhist temples. So when I look to the other examples around the world, I just feel it's a matter of time before the ideas are just so good that everyone will want to do them. And once we can perhaps get a few more structural incentives in place, the ideas could take off very, very quickly. But right now, what we mostly have is structural barriers in terms of at least U.S. policy. So at least for now, we have to enjoy the initiatives of others and wait and see when they'll be able to be sprung loose on our own society.
Yes, I often wonder what the impetus or many impetus sources of impetus will be to slow us down. You mentioned community several times actually so far, and I want to get back to that for a minute, because the whole sense of community in a country that's founded on individualism seems to be an issue, don't you think?
It's very strong, and I find that my students are raising this question quite a bit. It's a big buzzword, and they want it. There are a number of classes around community, and they are expressing, I think, for the whole society, a deep hunger for something that is a stabilizing social force. They're not interested in anybody yet telling them what to do. They still are retaining a sense of individualism, but they want very much to form community bonds, whether it's through social action, just, you know, enjoying each other together, or whether it's through working politically, as we saw many young people got involved in the last campaign. But they're reaching out for that. They see that it's the balance is too far off in this country compared to other places they've traveled. And I think when you sense that kind of hunger, something will rise up to meet it. This was, of course, illustrated very strongly after 9/11, and I would say also in the aftermath of much of what we're hearing about Iraq, when people are upset or feel something is wrong or they're questioning it, they turn to others, and they need the support of others in community. In the Buddhist frame, community is seen as one of the three jewels. The other two are the Buddha, the teacher, and the Dharma, the teachings. And then community was thought originally as the monastic community, but among modern environmental Buddhists, community is interpreted as meaning the entire earth community. And taking care of each of those three jewels is seen as central to your practice. And the main guiding precepts, which would be kind of similar to the Christian commandments, are ways to take care of those three things. So community is of equal importance to understanding the teachings and the teacher. And even more broadly, the teacher is seen as, can be seen as being more than the historical Buddha. It could be the pine tree that you sit under, or the lake that you're studying, that you're trying to learn from, or the community of people you sing with. Those all could be considered, you know, teachers with their own teachings in a very broadest sense. So taking care of the earth community and the human community become quite intertwined. In fact, and I was reading a psychology textbook on this very thing, environmental psychology, and people generating tree planting events wondered out loud, was the tree planting generating the community, or was the community generating the tree planting? And that's a wonderful example, any kind of restoration projects where people have the opportunity to fall in love with their land and their friends and their neighborhoods again, and they just find it so satisfying that they actually really would rather do that than go shopping. So there's an antidote here that is very threatening to consumer marketing, that the happier people are, the more content they are with their friends and their family and going for walks and simple things that don't cost anything, why, that could really shut down the economy.
Right.
So it's kind of profound what any action people will take relative to consumption definitely will have a ripple effect. Something like farmers markets and community-supported agriculture or planting your own garden already is having an effect on the food shipping economy. So in that sense, I'm very excited and hopeful about this field because there's so much creativity, and small actions that make sense are easily picked up and shared and passed along to others and adopted. So if the culture wants something more meaningful than a consumer society, it can head in that direction. And I think we are definitely seeing signs that that's happening.
Right, I agree. Again, I'd like to remind listeners, we're speaking today on Alternative Currents with Stephanie Kaza, author of Hooked, Buddhist Writings on Greed, Desire, and the Urge to Consume. Stephanie, where you see classes of students most every day, I would imagine you're getting a lot of feedback or input from the youth, you know, of, well, the, yes, those of us looking at our generation, you're being able to get a real bird's eye view into the generation that's coming up. And I really enjoy Sumi Laundon's essay, uh-huh. Young Buddhists in Shopping Shangri-La.
Uh-huh.
Can you speak a little bit about how she sees young Buddhists as being different or the same as people in more our generation?
Well, she does categorize young Buddhists. I was particularly interested in this, too, so that the book would show a more multi-generational perspective. She herself was raised in a very strict Zen household, and she's actually quite critical of it, but it sounds like it was pretty austere and puritanical, really. But she has found a number of people that were raised in these kinds of Buddhist settings who have rejected an anti-consumer message, and they're as happy to be consumers as anybody else. So that's one category of people. But then she also finds people that have somewhat reformed, you know, who realized using Buddhism, perhaps, that consumption was not not bringing them so much happiness, and perhaps they, if they reduced it, they would be happier. But the interesting group to me that she shows us that is definitely different from the older generation is the group that is drawn to Buddhism through consumerism. They've gone to see movies about Buddhism, or they've bought the small mala beads and are wearing them around their arms, or they have gone to a rock concert by the Beastie Boys or another Buddhist-inspired group, and through their spending of money or purchasing of objects, they've become somewhat intrigued by Buddhism. Now, one major difference is that the generation of that are now in their 50s and 60s had virtually no Buddhist paraphernalia to even buy, hardly even any books in the 60s. But this generation of today, going into the 21st century, has a tremendous amount to draw on. There's many, many books on the shelves from many fine teachers, whom they call us the baby boomers, who've paved the way, who've really broken some ground. And there's much fine Buddhist artwork available. And then, of course, there's now Buddhist prayer flags and T-shirts and mugs and everything you could imagine. Interestingly, she contrasts this with young Buddhists in Asia, who aren't so interested in the material goods, but are very directed in using their Buddhism for success and achievement. And these young students are majoring in business and economics and really want to get ahead, whereas it seems like the Buddhist youth in America are majoring in English or art or the humanities and don't seem to have much of a career goal. So just by painting kind of a global picture, she shows some of the ambiguities and conflicts and diversity in expression as Buddhism is moving from culture to culture. And myself, I think what we'll see from this generation in the next 10, 20 years is a great sharing of their perspectives, because they have a very global sense of communication and a great interest in talking to each other across every culture. And this is enabled by the internet and by cell phone technology and now by music exchange through iPod technology and so on. So they freely sample from everything and sort of imagine that really anybody could be a friend. So I think we will start to see more and more collaboration and integration and conversation across the different perspectives on Buddhism and consumerism around the globe as this younger generation develops its own thinking about things. And it should be very exciting to watch.
The other essay I found real interesting in that multi-generational category that we speak of is Diana Winston's essay on You Are What You Download, because so many of us have found community on the internet, and
right,
conscious community on the internet, and activist community on the internet for good causes. I mean, pro-environmental causes and so on, it being easy to go and just sign up with different sites from Amnesty International to NARAL and be able to just email senators and representatives and so on. So, you know, being able to look at both sides of that, the hypnotic quality of the LCD screen or the computer screen, similar to a television kind of thing, is one way of looking at it. You know, how do we extract ourselves from that and remain mindful while utilizing this amazing tool for world transformation in a way?
It's a really big challenge, and I thought it would be very important to address that in this book. And I thought somebody who was younger, who had spent even more time, what higher percentage of their life, engaged with a computer, would be the right person to write this piece. And in fact, I especially appreciate that Diana writes it with so much humor, because it's impossible to come up with immediate answers. But she does talk about some possible mindfulness practices of taking breaks or trying to have little things that maybe a screensaver that comes up that reminds you to breathe temporarily, or to spend as much time outside as you spend on the computer. But even more than that, to look at how it actually makes our bodies feel and to study our own minds. And I know myself that 5 hours on a computer, whether it's doing word processing or emailing or internet searching, and I feel pretty bleary-eyed and kind of toxic hangover. And it helps if I have to walk a mile or so home just to kind of detox. But otherwise, it can leave a sort of irritable sourness that's not a very healthy feeling in your own body. So I think her big invitation is, let's just really look at this. What actually is going into our consciousness? And can we choose how we want to manage that kind of downloading so that it generates health rather than suffering? Because certainly it can generate addiction as much as anything else, and it can certainly generate a lot more consumption.
Definitely.
Because, as she points out, the time gap between when you say you want something and when you can get it, it has been reduced to nanoseconds. You see it, and you just add it to your shopping cart, and that's that. So she raises some very important issues, I think, with a good sense of humor, and I kind of see her essay as a signifier for the whole volume, because this is not a book about answers. It's really a book about questions and about looking deeply and trying to use time-tested Buddhist methods to expose as much as possible of what is going on in consumption and consumerism so we can all become more aware and just less in the grip of it and more able to be intelligent and perhaps load the odds that some of these more sustainable initiatives will last longer than the unsustainable ones.
Yeah, I'd like to read again a little bit from Winston's essay. The revolutionary insight brought to us by the Buddha is that actually it is painful to want. Letting go of wanting stops the pain. Getting what we want only temporarily soothes the wound. Buddhist wisdom teaches us that a desire doesn't have to be fulfilled to make it go away. We can recognize and let go of the desire. We can break the chain. All we have to do is catch a single point on the cycle. And then her humor comes in. Oh, look, there's a pleasant contact with a desirable pair of boots. Oh, I feel body sensations of longing for them. Oh, I feel myself wanting. If we can bring mindfulness here, we can break the chain. It is up to us. We are not slaves to an automatic process. I love that line.
That's really the truth. And this chain she refers to is one of the well-developed teachings in Buddhism, the 12 links of codependent origination, in which the Buddha actually describes what happens in the mind, that you have sensory contact, and then it generates a feeling state, and then the feeling generates the grasping or the desire. And then it goes on from there until you're really hooked in a very complex way into that needing. We're not generally very practiced in that letting go option. And it's hard to kind of get started on it as a practice. But when you do, it gets easier and easier. And simultaneously, you're able to recognize that this is just a passing thought or a passing desire and passing feeling. And the deeper a sense of contentment is what's holding me in a stable place, able to recognize this, letting go. I'm afraid too often in our material society where we can have everything we want, we have relatively few practices in letting go. We just go and add more to our stash. And then, you know, if somebody has a terrible fire, we feel so sorry for them because they have to let go of everything. But if it could be, you know, moderated more and letting go as a regular part of the way you work with your mind, this would become a lot easier along the way.
Right. Stephanie, we have just a couple of minutes left. Is there anything you'd like to say before closing or bring up?
Well, I've addressed consumerism, obviously, here in many of its problems using a Buddhist lens, and I would like to say that what's particularly unique about a Buddhist view is that it goes right to the heart of looking at people's suffering. And so that cuts through a lot, and so we're trying to see what kinds of suffering is generated by consumerism, suffering for animals, plants, ecosystems, human beings, labor forces, etc. So this provides a very powerful kind of analysis. You don't have to be a Buddhist practitioner to understand it. And looking again, as we talked about earlier, about how the self is constructed, the ego self, the false sense of self, to study that and the suffering generated from that and how that relates to desire. And then perhaps another key Buddhist aspect that comes through here is interdependence. And this, of course, we're learning so much from ecology about interdependence and the chain of custody and the products as they're made. So we can really use these things from Buddhism very helpfully and perhaps even eventually in interreligious dialogue as well because I think religions do have a lot to offer in questioning some of the assumptions in consumerism. That religion has the role of moral authority and has, of course, a huge social capital of members and even quite a lot of financial resources and the skill and capacity to build community. So whether one belongs to a world religion or not, I think I at least stand in the position of championing world religions where they can take on these difficult issues and really see, could we change the light bulbs in our church, or could we offer fair trade coffee? And we're just at the very, very beginning stages of all this. So by bringing together a few examples in this book, I hope to stimulate even more dialogue and encourage people to raise these same very difficult questions in as non-judgmental a way as they can, with as much humor as possible, just realizing we're all in this soup together. And it's going to be a while we try and find our way through it to what makes the most sense for a sustainable world.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. This has been Stephanie Kaza on Alternative Currents, talking about her new book, Hooked, Buddhist Writings on Greed, Desire, and the Urge to Consume, published by Shambhala.
In life for free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want. Your love gives me such a thrill, but your love won't pay my bills. I want money. Everything, it's true. What it don't get, I can't use. I want money.
Thanks for listening to today's Alternative Currents, and as always, information on this or any future program is available on WERU's website, weru.org, under Programmers Notes, or email me at my website, bellajohnson.com. Thanks for listening.